Welcome to this fresh episode of The World According to Irina Zuckerman, our very special series on global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. Irina Zuckerman, as you can see her on the screen, she is a US-based national security and human rights lawyer, as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. Every fortnight in The World According to Irina Zuckerman, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. And today we'll be talking about a lot of things with her. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thank you. And it's nice always talking to you, you know, and thank you, viewers, for all the love that you have shown to this special series and that motivates us to bring much more deep insights, you know, on the geopolitical situation that we are facing today. So several big topics today. One, let's first get to the big topic, Irina, that is the Blinken's trips to Israel and CIA Chief Bill Burns also trip to the Middle East. How do you see, and on the other side, Saudi Defense Minister, he was in the US. How do you see all these trips and what can the world, you know, especially someone sitting in India, can make sense of what this is all about?
Well, I'll explain what the trips were about, then I'll explain why they were a complete failure and what should have been said instead. Burns' trip was slightly better than Blinken, because they were focused on more logistical issues of security cooperation, given the whole situation with the war and the increasing number of proxies entering the field. At the end of the day, however, Burns is not a decision maker. He can only adjust the strategy of intelligence gathering, which up until now has been a failure on US side as much as on Israel's side, for the reason that US has actually stopped the monitoring of Hamas for the past several years, having decided that Hamas is a local issue, that it presents no direct danger to the United States, and essentially it would be a waste of resources to focus on it, which is surprising because the agency has a very big personnel. It has over 100,000 employers, and you would think that at least a small group could be dedicated to Hamas. But apparently that was not the case. So now there is an effort to fix the gap, to coordinate actions, to coordinate responses. And it's difficult to do in the fog of war. But that sort of visit is to be expected and should probably have happened a lot sooner. In terms of Blinken, however, that was a complete failure. He has been playing shuttle diplomacy between Israel and various Middle Eastern states. On the one hand, the administration claims victories in the sense of getting Israel to agree to a number of humanitarian gestures. And even now, Israel stated it is considering short humanitarian pauses. It has allowed exit of Palestinian refugees to humanitarian corridors in the south. And there's also been a corridor for foreign nationals leaving Gaza and entering Egypt for treatment. And now the latest is that there's been an arrangement with Turkey and Egypt to transport cancer patients from the hospital in Egypt to Turkey. Israel has also allowed Jordan to bring to airdrop humanitarian aid, and the Emiratis are also now providing medical treatment, building a hospital inside Gaza. So from that sense, the administration can claim credit for going a very long way to provide civilians in Gaza with assorted forms of humanitarian relief. But they have failed to secure the release of hostages. According to Qatar, which has been an intermediary in the process, there would need to be a ceasefire of some sort for the hostages to be released. Israel, on the other hand, demands that the hostages to be released before there is any comprehensive stop to hostilities. Israel has gone quite far into Gaza. It has divided the area by half. It has destroyed a number of tunnels and thousands of terrorists belonging to Hamas. It has killed a number of commanders, but so far has failed to secure some of its leading targets, such as Yahya Sinwar and Mohammed Adaif, who are nowhere to be found. It even encouraged the locals to try to kill them in order to save civilian lives. It is approaching the Al-Shifa hospital, where Hamas has its headquarters, and it has surrounded Gaza City. So from a territorial perspective, it has made a lot of progress, but there seems to be no end to hostilities. And Blinken has attempted to persuade Israel to put a stop to all of this, to allow the securing the release of the hostages, to provide further humanitarian relief, and to also get other Arab states on board. But so far, with no success, Israel does not believe it serves its military and security agenda to put a stop. Furthermore, there's been evidence that from the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, as it's known in Israel, the areas under the Palestinian Authority control, there is a potential effort to replicate the Hamas attack, with at least 1,000 trained terrorists looking to breach the borders, to breach the divisions, and enter Israel proper. So Netanyahu has asked the army to prepare for that. But Blinken, now I'll explain the reason why Blinken has failed to get attention from anybody. With Israel, it's pretty obvious that they view any stop to combat as an opportunity for Hamas to rearm and reload, as every proxy, every Iranian and Muslim Brotherhood proxy in the region has done during conflicts, even ones unrelated to Israel. Any humanitarian pauses essentially an invitation for the fighters to secure additional weapons, aid, and to regroup. But the Arab states have been pushing for the ceasefire as a condition to any sort of expansion of diplomatic efforts. The reality, however, is that Blinken had not brought anything to the table from the diplomatic perspective. He has promised on behalf of President Biden to push for a two-state solution, but that sort of discussion is clearly premature during this, while the fighting is still ongoing and while the situation is unresolved. The transition plan that Israel discusses may include potential long-term control of Israelis over Gaza, which would be, on the one hand, unacceptable to the Arab states, on the other hand, expensive and difficult for Israel, and possibly not actually resolve anything, because at the end of the day, the war is as much political and ideological as it is military. And the biggest central issue to all of this is not the Palestinian state, which, by the way, has been rejected by Palestinian governments in much more peaceful times than now. The biggest issue is that nobody's talking about the elephant in the room, which is Iran. And the fact that Iran is calling the shots not only on Hamas hostilities, but on Houthis, who had been firing missiles at Israel, at the US, who have been attacking Saudi Arabia multiple times, and Iraqi and Syrian militias, which have attacked the US bases in their respective countries for over 40 times now, injuring in many cases severely at least 45 members of the US military. Until the start of Iran is actually brought up and discussed, I don't really see how anyone in the Arab world will take this shuttle diplomacy effort seriously. Their security and economic interests are simply not being met by anything Blinken is bringing to the table.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Irina, from an outsider's perspective, what do we understand from this? What does the U.S. want? We all are hearing many voices, and U.S. and Israel, after Biden's visit, all this, if their communication is so good, Why does the US have to travel again and again to Israel and to other nations around it? Is it such a difficult part of them to lay down something concrete and move forward? Or is it just much more of optics, posturing, and giving a chance for other countries also, you know, that, okay, you keep on making some noises, we are with you, let Israel do what it wants, let the way it wants to, but actually, is it moving towards any concrete solution to this issue? Does the world is fearing it might lead to escalation of this crisis, but nobody is getting a clear picture where this goes is, what does US want? Israel, we know it's a tough situation, it's a tough posturing at the moment, but the humanitarian crisis, more than 10,000 people dead, a lot of, you know, even among the European Union, there have been now several voices out there. How do we understand in terms of solution? The world wants to see a solution, not a stalemate.
Well, the problem is this administration has no strategy for settling the conflict. They can't force Israel to drop the issue before the military goals achieved. And the military goals are not unreasonable. Even President Biden, that he supports the idea of relieving Hamas of its control over Gaza. Secretary Blinken today described the way Hamas holds uses civilians as human shields. He went into great detail discussing why there are so many civilian casualties, which are unavoidable because Hamas has completely infiltrated every civilian institution. And I think there is, first of all, a split within the administration as to what to do, and second, a very awkward effort to balance different interests between allowing Israel to secure its borders from terrorism and to put an end to Hamas stronghold, and then to respond to all the critics pushing for a ceasefire, and there's a lot of them, including in the United States. There have been mass rallies from all sorts of people. Some of them are pro-Hamas voices, and some of them are assorted human rights activists who may be well-informed, but they're loud, they're vocal, and they're very visible. And of course, there's some pressure from Europe and from around the world as well. There is an effort to continue to shield Iran from accountability, and this is why we haven't seen any concrete military response to all the regional escalations. But we have seen increasing number of visible deterrents, such as the nuclear submarine that has just been transferred to the Middle East. There's a concern about China. The President Biden is preparing for the meeting with Xi Jinping and trying to settle some of the tensions, just as China is apparently getting more involved in the Middle East in a more visible way. So there is a lot going on. And of course, the Arab states have not been quiet either. There's been a mass exodus of diplomats from a number of countries from Israel. And the Israeli diplomats have also been kicked out of a couple of places. And Israel has also had to withdraw a number of ambassadors for his security reasons from several countries. So there's been a lot of political controversy that the administration is trying to navigate. And the problem is it's trying to please too many interests with no real next step vision of where it's all going. There's no plan for the transition from Hamas rule to something else, no plan to put an end to the financial support for Hamas from sources outside the Western world, no plan to deal with the Arab states or with the growing internal polarization over the issue. The administration is also suffering from political problems. Recent polls are showing a split in the Democrat fold over the Israel-Hamas war, with many of the Muslim and Arab constituents increasingly dissatisfied with the administration because they see that there's insufficient support for the Palestinian cause, as they claim it. The Jewish constituents are not happy with the response for the opposite reason. And so now, and and former President Trump appears to be gaining support in five key swing states. So we see both a policy and a political problem, and we see a very academic approach to all of that. There are no concrete deals being brokered. There are no political, there's no talk of political leveraging of any interests in order to gain some sort of a concrete solution. And the reason why there is no solution is because there are no proposals, there's no vision, and nobody really knows what to do. Everything we've seen so far is completely reactionary.
Absolutely, absolutely. At least, even if they may have something in their minds, it is not getting reflected, at least in this part of the world. We are not understanding what exactly is happening. And is if in this state of
we are in the same boat.
Right. So, Irina, as from one confusion, we're still trying to make sense of that. Let's move on to the Ukraine thing. You know, in the Economist article, they are criticizing Ukraine strategy and corruption. And the big part is rumors about U.S. pressure to give up territory to Russia. Is it about one more confusion coming on for the U.S.? What should we make out of that? It is a rumor, but you would know better. You have got great insights and information about all those things. So help us understand what is happening to Ukraine, what one may make out of the Economist article, and what can one make out of what is happening in the Ukraine Russia war.
So the US is facing a number of challenges. The primary challenge is that there's a shortage of professionals capable of navigating between multiple simultaneous crises. And by the way, most of these crises have the same set of actors who are involved in whatever capacity. So it's not like we have completely independent things happening at the same time. They're not completely independent, they are related. But we have a shortage of trained personnel. A lot of the foreign policy people in the Biden administrations come from very theoretical backgrounds and are not equipped to handle the political processes for dealing with these issues. And that, so it's not that they're becoming a complete distraction. Nobody has forgotten that Ukraine, that the war in Ukraine is still ongoing and needs to be dealt with and resolved. But there's a very strong fear of immediate escalation in the Middle East, where there's a number of U.S. troops physically stationed, unlike Ukraine, where they're only where their political personnel occasionally present in advisory capacity, but no direct U.S. involvement whatsoever. So it's not an issue of distraction, it's an issue of prioritizing more immediate and direct conflict where U.S. is more directly involved and where there is a more immediate concern about the expansion of conflict. Russia has been far more careful about pushing for its agenda more slowly through proxies in various parts of Europe, through political and the asymmetrical warfare, and less so also for logistical reasons. It cannot start major wars directly everywhere because it has a shortage of personnel, and most of its attention has been directed towards Ukraine at the moment. So while there is a fear that Russia will escalate and push its agenda over time, it's not as immediate as what we're seeing in the Middle East, where a number of proxies are active simultaneously. There is another issue, which is that the White House cannot really control Congress, and it has some leverage. It does not necessarily know how to use it wisely. It has its strategic proposals for dealing with the Ukraine aid have been shall we say, met with skepticism. First of all, due to initial failure to articulate concrete objectives and concrete strategies and to provide weapons in advance and not providing public discussion of what is necessary and for what purpose. So now we are facing a backlash from the Republicans in Congress who are fighting over budget, who've prioritized cutting Ukraine aid over all the other possible expenditures which could be and probably should be cut. And it's become a political football between parties, which a national security issue should never be, but we're operating in a very polarized climate with very poor communication and poor policy on both sides. So on the part of the Democrats, there's not a concrete vision because they're also double dealing with Russia. They're also buying metals from Russia, expanding their exports, trying to deal with Russia and China on climate change, this and that, not really fully going on all in on economic and financial level, and certainly not providing any concrete roadmap for enforcing a victorious military strategy with and for Ukraine. The Republicans, on the other hand, are making it seem like none of it is a big deal, does not concern the United States, and exaggerating the budget issue a great deal. Is this also a fight over whether Ukraine aid should be connected to Israel? And now there's a problem even with Israel aid, which is significantly less because Israel needs fewer weapons. It is already well equipped, but there are certain things that it needs for continuing to use the weapons that it has, the Iron Dome and so forth. But they have tried to tied to the reduction of budget on the IRS, which is completely unnecessary. Those could be separate bills, and the House has a Republican majority, and none of those bills will go through Senate. So we are at a stalemate. Republicans are refusing to negotiate with the Democrats. The border issue, which has also been tied into all this, has been a disaster because it does not really deal with border security so much as expanding the processing power of the migrants entering through the southern border. So it does not address either Republican, for that matter, growing Democratic concerns. So all of these political issues are just not being well dealt with by anybody in this equation. There simply is a political morass with absolutely no progress whatsoever.
Absolutely, absolutely. All this infighting is going to impact Israel, Gaza, Ukraine, Taiwan. And, you know, so we don't know what's going to happen to all these situations.
And it's very concerning as well, because some of the issues that The Economist pointed out points to mistakes within the Ukrainian governance that are not being well dealt with. There is a concern over recent issue involving the fact that a general who wrote this article has been reprimanded for pointing out that the war is at a stalemate. President Zelensky disagrees with this characterization and views this as a defeatist commentary that will likely undermine support. Others criticize that the overly optimistic PR strategy by Ukrainian lobbyists, which has created a false impression that Ukraine does not, in fact, really need a lot of American help, and that we are wasting resources by continuing to give money. So there's been this discrepancy that needs to be resolved. There needs to be a unified strategy from Ukraine, and right now is not the time to play politics.
Right, right, Irina. What do we make out of this? Lots of pro-Hamas rallies around the world and increasing anti-Semitism. You know, how do we deal with this? What can people understand about these things? You know, because Hamas is a totally different thing. Anti-Semitism on the rise is also very alarming. How should people look at it? Are we seeing much more polarization in the coming days all through the world? Is there a chance for more peace, or is it going to be a difficult world going forward?
Well, first of all, I don't think there's an increase in anti-Semitism. I think there's an increase in public expression of anti-Semitism. In other words, people who previously had reasons to stay quiet now feel unencumbered by social restraints to come out and publicly say it. Sometimes it's due to the way their governments behave and not take the serious issues. Sometimes it's because they feel that their numbers collectively have grown sufficient and their political and social influence is sufficient. And sometimes because they feel that Israel is in a weak position, US is polarized, Europe does not have a unified position on anything. And so they feel empowered to come out much more strongly and to take action in a way that they would not have previously. In big cities in the US, for instance, there has been a problem with law and order even before the war. there has been a rise in crime due to the policies in those cities. None of that has gone away once the war started. So this general attitude that has allowed crime to proliferate is now giving room for political expressions and politically motivated crimes to take place as well. The other issue is that over decades, there's been cultivation of radical views through various institutions in the US, and as well as a congregation of politically radical pro-Islamist sympathizers who've grown up listening to that sort of rhetoric in their religious institutions, family circles, and so forth. And there's been no effort to understand that ideology on either government or academic level. There has been essentially a disinterest in it. And I think this leaves the West completely unprepared to confront the reality of these worldviews and ideologies once they become prevalent and publicly active. We have seen these manifestations before during Women's March, and some of these, we've seen expressions of this anti-Semitic conduct in Congress. All of that has encouraged a sort of activity on the street. Even if Rashida Tlaib today is censored by the House, which she was, she's already been in Congress for three terms, which has allowed her to grow her audience, to kind of create a sense of political impunity. And so whoever is already radicalized now feels more confident in coming out in greater numbers, and others who are critical of such views now feel less powerful, less equipped to confront and to reject those sorts of ideologies. So on the one hand, we have a growing power of hate and bigotry and fanaticism motivated groups. On the other hand, less equipment, less backing, less law enforcement interest for whoever is opposed to such views, whether in Muslim communities or outside of them. So we are seeing the power dynamic shift, which encourages these voices.
Right, right. From here now, let's move to the Pacific Islands Forum and Australian PM's trip to China. What do you see? Ongoing Pacific Island Forum, for several top leaders are not attending it for whatever home issues they have. And Australia's Prime Minister, in the meantime, visit to China. Is it, Australia-China ties are finally defrosting. First visit went to China by an Australian leader in 7 years. How do you see all this forum? Is Pacific Island Forum is going to be actually impactful this time? And what is your understanding of the Australian PM's trip to China?
I think it's a very strong signal, strategic communication, when a head of state goes to a country and then doesn't, when there is a number of high level representatives who fail to appear at a major gathering. When, for instance, recently President Biden chose not to attend Asian Forum and chose to send the vice president instead, even though it was still a high level visit, it sent a signal that it's not a priority. Similarly, the leaders who are not attending this forum are saying that this gathering is not a priority. And the optics are that the real story is happening with the Australian Prime Minister's visit to China, and therefore the Pacific Forum, which would probably normally confront issues involving China, is taking a back seat. Maybe it's not contradicting the agenda completely, not reversing its course, but it's certainly being seen as less important. This is not the main thrust of the policy right now. And therefore, I'm not sure what kind of impact it is to have when mostly lower level officials are attending, and this major trip has just happened. I think we can expect a very drawn down, muted discussion with very few concrete resolutions and policies for the future, but we can probably try. There's probably an effort to gather some sort of a unified response, some commitments to some, practical cooperation measures among the members towards economic, and security cooperation of some sort. But again, it will not carry as much weight in terms of public policy as the trip to China. Now, what do I make from the trip itself? To me, it shows a radical shift in Australia's direction, probably following the parallel optics of what is happening in the United States as President Biden is preparing for the visit with the Xi Jinping in San Francisco in the near future. And the government in Australia has previously dedicated a strong response, claiming that they are committed to confronting and countering China and so on and so forth, but actions speak louder than words. China has so far not backed away from any of its meddling activities in Australia, and there hasn't been any intermediate steps between the two countries. So this high-level visit out of nowhere without trust-building measures, to me, smacks of kind of appeasement and desperation on the part of that particular portion of the Australian government, which, by the way, I don't think all of it necessarily approves of everything that happens. Just like in the United States, institutions sometimes and agencies sometimes have parallel policies. I believe that this political step does not necessarily align with everyone's vision in Australia, but I do think that they believe that because China is in an economically difficult situation, and because there are some narrow issues which could be discussed, China will be more likely to at least not escalate or agree to some sort of establishing communications mechanisms for avoiding further problems in the future. Doesn't mean that they will necessarily resolve all their problems immediately. It means they agree to continue negotiating and to look for diplomatic solutions to differences. Personally, I don't buy any of it. To put it bluntly, China has been very consistent with its course of action, and it uses these diplomatic pauses much as Hamas would use humanitarian pauses to regroup. It is buying time by engaging in this diplomatic subterfuge precisely to get concessions from Australia without necessarily making any major policy concessions on its own. In other words, China is not going to change any of its damaging behavior. It can agree to some business deals, to some new mechanisms, but none of it will change these old things that will continue as they are. So actually, I think they will see this visit as a sign of weakness, because it has been granted to them. You have a prime minister traveling to them and asking for a meeting without any process in between that would prepare ground for such a visit. So I really don't think it was well handled at all. And I think it will cause a great deal of damage to Australia's future efforts to blunt China's influence, even if all other institutions are trying to do exactly what I described. This one big visible step for China, from China's perspective, is a sign of a capitulation in some way, political capitulation to China's position. They don't view these events the same way as Westerners do. For Westerners, a high-level meeting is a sign of partnership. For China, it's a sign of a power play. They got what they wanted.
Okay. For optics purpose, China has got lots of, you know, good photographs, images, and, you know, while they send out a much more diplomatic sort of, you know, that China is approachable, countries can do business with China with this Australian Prime Minister visit. China, in the meantime, will be able to take care of its internal issues, including the economy. How do you look out? Is Australia getting anything out of it? Or is it only there for, along with China, some good pictures for the Australian Prime Minister?
I think the Australian Prime Minister is looking to use it as a sort of diplomatic win to bring to his own political supporters. I also think he honestly believes he can get some minor concessions from China that it will avoid more direct confrontations. So this is an avoidance mechanism from his perspective. I don't think it will. I think it's basically kicking the can down the road, and not even to the some future administration. It may just buy everyone a few weeks or 3 months' time until China and the ball is in China's court decides it's time to violate whatever short-term arrangements it has made. And we won't know when that is, because again, China is the one in control of that situation.
Right, right. So, Irina, now let's move on to India-Canada relations now. We thought that it is going towards the mend, but I see this now new diplomatic situation. Indian High Commissioner in Ottawa, Sanjay Verma, he accused Canada for again on this tainted probe, as he called it. And you know, there was that this they did not share anything of importance so that India could do needful or anything, any sort of a looking at this. And at the same time, now there are these threats coming on with Khalistani leader video and all that stuff of danger to the Air India carrier. So that's the problem. That and they have specified that a date also, 19th November. How do you look at all these things happening in terms of India-Canada relations? India, you know, looking at the whole situation, India is also right to protect itself in every way it is coming. And people are here amidst all these threats and you know, of terrorism along the way.
Now, the biggest question everyone had when this whole issue broke out was, why didn't India simply petition for the release of these Khalistani separatists into its custody for extradition of people who made threats? Now, my understanding is that the claim from Canada's side, general speaking, is that such requests were not made, but even if they were, many of these people have been granted asylum and citizenship, and therefore it is against Canada's political position to do anything, and they did not take the whole issue seriously. Now, it seems to me that my understanding of the situation is that it appears, as the more of the story comes out, is that such overtures in various forms have been made. There were discussions about this issue. There were discussions about concrete individuals who appeared to be directly involved in plotting of the activity on Indian soil from Canada's territory, much as we have discussed the issue of Hamas plotting attacks on Israel inside Turkey. We are seeing that Canada has essentially given a platform to these separatists to plot attacks somewhere else. And because these attacks were not in Canada, although there have been terrorist attacks against Canada as well, which likewise were kept as a separate matter from whatever was going on in India, in my opinion, a huge mistake. Strategic mistake. I'm not even talking about a moral case. I'm talking about law enforcement. Now, it seems to me that the story was less clear, that there was this engaged discussion, and that essentially, from India's perspective, Canada was impeding its own ability to take care of its domestic issues by harboring all these individuals. And the more time passed, the more the conflict became intensified in India, and you know, the worse it all looked from the perspective of all these people having unfettered access to Canadian institutions to do what they were doing. I'm not entirely sure how all of that will ultimately be resolved, but I only see one real way to resolve it, which is to come to an agreement to navigate this law enforcement aspect, and for Canada to start taking these issues seriously, if only for its own sake. These individuals are clearly dangerous. And now, as if, you know, you would think from a logical perspective, Canada is sort of giving, you know, shielding these individuals from foreign efforts to deal with them, whether by extraditing, assassinating, whatever you want. You would think that at this point they would be smart enough to keep their mouths shut and not make public threats that discredit the policy of the government that is protecting them. That is not the case. Now we have a Khalistani terrorist openly threatening to blow up Indian airplanes, which is as direct a terrorist threat as you can imagine. That puts Prime Minister Trudeau in a very foolish position after he came out publicly with accusations against India, and now they kind of discredited his entire claim to Canadian sovereignty because someone in just claimed that they will blow up airplanes full of civilians traveling for their own purposes. All of that is extremely counterproductive to security issues. All of that is not helpful to the Indian-Canadian relations at all. And I think at this point, Canada should make some sort of clear statement that any sort of threat like that will not be tolerated, and that people engaging in terrorism who are naturalized citizens, their papers should be reviewed. Making threats of violence is the opposite of, you know, a genuine asylum claim. If you're a terrorist or national security threat, you should not be entitled to that sort of protection. And you should not be allowed to use that Canadian soil to engage in crime or terrorism abroad either. It's counterproductive. If they don't want India getting involved, then they should take measures and put these people on trial. That's the only way to really resolve this issue to mutual satisfaction and to avoid potential tragedies in the future. I don't know how serious the threat is. I have no way of telling it. But when somebody threatens to kill you, I think generally it's a good idea to take it seriously.
Absolutely, absolutely. With all these tensions going on, this diplomatic row, you know, moving in a very different direction than anticipated, amidst all these things, you see, Israel has called, I read it a news report that because of the lot of work they're getting stalled because of all these issues down there, they are looking at Indian workers, more than 100,000 Indian workers going to Israel. That's the report I read. More details I'll have to see. So that is a good sign that there is, you know, there is a lot of market for Indian workers outside, you know, and this is a good thing. How do you see India's role, growing role in the Middle East, in this whole thing, politically as well as in terms of the economic aspect? Because India has been a part of a lot of growth, even in difficult regions, and politically also it has been long aligned, but along with that, it has also has to take care of its political interests via, you know, international relations and all that.
Well, from an economic perspective, I think India is becoming a major player, not only by virtue of all the workers that are now in various GCC countries and now coming to Israel, which is extremely impactful and contributes to any major successes in those countries, but also on a more strategic level, as we have seen from various agreements concluded during the last G20 meetings. Even if, due to the political situations, they do not fully materialize as planned, what we see clearly from that is a strategic direction for asserting and projecting power in the Middle East, for engaging in bilateral and multilateral high-level initiatives, for having a lot to contribute and being seen as a very important economic factor, strategic factor, and also looking to counter China's influence, particularly the Belt and Road Initiative, in a very concrete and clear way. That much is evident. And there's another aspect to the story, which is India is also a place rich with natural resources, in that it is also providing a potential alternative to China. It also has growing and strong relations in Africa, another aspect where there may be a new challenge to China's increasing monopoly in those countries. And we are seeing that there is smaller countries all over the world are now seeing for an alternative to China, because China is not necessarily the kindly uncle that everybody has that it has presented itself as. Now all these smaller countries owe $1.1 trillion to China in debt, which means a potential takeover of all of their critical infrastructure and virtual financial slavery, you know, or tributary status to China. That is not something anyone wants. And I think many of these countries may look to India as a potential country who may wish to buy out some of their debt in the future, which would put India in an extremely financially powerful position and could be a huge response to China's economic efforts. From a political perspective, we are seeing another role. India has very good relations with most countries in the Middle East, without necessarily being seen as a politically as a militarily assertive power, which presents it as an ideal broker for many future situations, in a way that some of the Middle Eastern countries who have tried to do that have not been really successful or have not acted in good faith necessarily. India could play that role while being seen as genuinely neutral on many issues. It has had a positive relations with both Israelis and Palestinians. In terms of conflict, there has been a shift in India's position. It has shifted from being relatively neutral in the conflict, and some would say more pro-Palestinian leaning, to being very anti-terrorism. I wouldn't say it's become anti-Palestinian. It has, under Prime Minister Modi, has set out a very clear anti-extremist position and has grown close to Israel over a variety of mutually beneficial issues. So I think that has been a major, major factor. I think it will, such a position will ultimately benefit everyone, including Palestinians themselves, and certainly Middle Eastern countries aside from Israel, who also, without necessarily stating it out loud, for political reasons, feel that Hamas and other terrorist organizations are a threat to their own security and security interests. Egypt is one of those countries, certainly. So we can see that India in the future, its political role in countering extremism may be called upon as well for cooperation with all these actors.
Right, right. And staying with India, you know, about this iPhone hacking news. How did you see this news? What is the understanding that you get of it? You know, because India is also looking at it in its own way, and Apple has its own statement on this. Help us, you know, from your perspective, how do you see this whole iPhone hacking stuff happening?
I've been following this issue for several years, because this is exactly how long it's been ongoing since 2016. It didn't start with India, but India became a major target, especially as its relations with Israel on security issues has grown closer. Not all of these articles explicitly mention it, but the major target of these hacking accusations has been against Israeli software. And there's been a concerted effort to divide and break up relations between India and Israel on those grounds, and to force India to look for other options due to the bad optics from the various scandals related to these accusations. Now, if you look at it, Apple has not been a disinterested actor. Apple has used it for its own publicity. Apple has tried to dominate security market among iPhone phones with very mixed results, because these hacking attempts have revealed a number of significant vulnerabilities. So it has viewed these Israeli security companies as business competition, quite simply, and as an embarrassment to its own efforts to dominate this sphere. So there's a bad faith interest on Apple's part. It has worked with a number of NGOs that focus on digital rights and that have ties to assorted state and non-state actors, ranging from other big tech companies with particular interests in the area, to George Soros, to Russia, China, and Qatar, and Muslim Brotherhood entities. All of these have actually backed the digital NGOs, digital rights NGOs, that have sent out reports on Apple's behalf, claiming that these Israeli security companies are the ones responsible for these hacks with nary a technical evidence. None of it has been released to the public fully. And there's been an intermix of experts among these digital angels, some with very dubious professional credentials in digital forensics. Essentially, just to put it bluntly, I'm not an expert in this area, but it's been a lot of propaganda without much evidence. And some of the lawsuits against these Israeli companies in the US have already been thrown out. What's most interesting is that examining these efforts, I noticed that a peak in accusations occurs during politically significant events. In this particular case, the accusations against India have emerged at the same time as accusations against Azerbaijan. Why these two countries, which have actually at various points have been at odds with each other over various political issues, certainly back different regional camps, they have one major thing in common, which is their very positive relations with Israel, security and defense cooperation, growing economic and energy cooperation, and both of them backed Israel in this instant conflict with Hamas. And these accusations once again emerged at a significantly a politically significant time at the peak of the conflict between Israel and Hamas. So if we look at the past claims, they have also in the past been coordinated with significant events, peaks of different conflicts, pre-election or election periods in various countries. So none of it has just been random. It has also always been tied to some important political events, which leads me to believe that Apple and all these actors are looking to use propaganda and these accusations on human rights to meddle and influence policy in those countries, specifically towards anti-Israel perspective in this particular case, but also in general to favor their particular constituencies they are trying to protect, who are generally aligned with Iran, China, Russia, Islamists, and by Russia, I mean specifically intelligence agencies and not just random, you know, Russian citizens.
Right, right. A lot is happening in the world, and a lot of minds are working overtime. And let's be that as it may, let's move to Bangladesh now. Now, that is a problem area that is coming up in terms of political turmoil sweeping Bangladesh, and its economy is already, you know, facing its tough challenges. How do you see that? Opposition is asking for Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign ahead of the general election expected in January. How do you see this politics impacting economics, especially when Bangladesh is in such a difficult position at the moment?
Well, none of it is particularly surprising for those of us observing the situation in Bangladesh for the past many years. It has suffered from a lack of democracy, lack of respect for the rights of the opposition groups, and extreme polarization between its parties. And the current leader, Sheikha Hasina, she's considered an ally by the United States, but if you look closer at her politics, there have been accusations of her support for Islamist terrorist groups and corruption, and of course, complete lack of respect for the opposition and their rights. People have disappeared. Political leaders have been arrested and thrown in prison with no clear legal justification. And economically, it seems that extreme groups have grown significantly because they provide some sort of a political and financial leeway for the government, which has otherwise been mismanaging the economy. And I think Bangladesh is heading very much in the direction of a potential turmoil or a situation similar to Sri Lanka and other, or even Pakistan, where they had to rely very much on China to bail them out with very negative results. If China gets involved in bailing out this whole and resolving the situation, it may put a stop to the economic turmoil, but it will not put a stop to political issues, and it will not solve them. China does not generally get directly involved in governance, and if it does, it's never good news for anybody, for either side. I'm not entirely sure what IMF and Western institutions are going to do, but it's very clear that once again the West has put its faith into the wrong person, the wrong hands. They have allowed a very illiberal process to take place over a number of decades and many years more recently, and there's been for reasons of convenience, because they have seen that politically Bangladesh appear to be going along with the general trends, even though internally the picture is quite the opposite. And if this breaks out, it could affect neighboring countries in the entire region, because terrorist and extremist groups take advantage of any form of chaos, and they certainly work across borders with each other, with groups in Indonesia, groups in Pakistan, India, with the certain groups in Malaysia and so forth. We can see a whole network building up from this one situation.
Absolutely. As mm-hmm. I said, and you know, there's a lot of things happening in the world. And you have, you know, in this new episode, you have explained and given us some understanding, better understanding of all that is happening, you know, which are sometimes very difficult to understand. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of The World According to Irina Shukerman. Thank you so much, and hope to see you again soon.
Thank you so much. Looking forward.